absorption and refrigeration. Want to be recorded or not, or don't you care?
I don't care, that doesn't even vary what's why.
Oh, you feel better today?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Is that okay?
About the Sorvel refrigerator, and I found that it's an ammonia absorption system. And Dr. Hall told me that there are some differences between this basic system and the Sorvel system, but I don't know exactly what they are. So I'll just explain the ammonia absorption refrigerator. In the late 1800s, there were several different kinds of refrigerators developed, and let me tell you a little bit about those first. The two main kinds were the kind that used air as a refrigerant and a material that could be vaporized and liquidized alternately. And that's the type that the ammonia absorption is. And this is based on two principles. The first is that when liquids vaporize, they absorb heat in the atmosphere around them. And that leaves the surrounding air refrigerated. And the second principle is that liquids can be made to evaporate violently or boil, and subsequently to condense or liquefy, again at temperatures that can be raised or lowered by increasing or decreasing the pressure. And there are two main types using these kind of liquids that can be vaporized. The first one is vapor compression. And this turned out to be the most important. And the difference with this kind is that low pressure was achieved by mechanical means. Now, in the ammonia absorption system, low pressure was achieved by the rapid absorption of ammonia gas by water. And let me show you exactly how, well, not exactly, but in sort of a general way how this is supposed to work. This is a refrigerator in this area right here.
That's the part that gets cold?
That's right. And right here is an expansion valve. Ammonia gas flows, well, it's a heavy substance. It's not quite, it's liquid here. And it flows through here and absorbs heat from the atmosphere surrounding it. And that turns it into a gas form. And then it comes down here and comes out this pipe into the compressor. And in here is an aqua ammonia solution, which is mostly water but has some ammonia in it. And this very rapidly absorbs this ammonia gas coming out of the pipes. At 80 degrees Fahrenheit and under normal atmospheric conditions, this solution will absorb about 1,000 times its own volume of ammonia gas. And this causes a great deal of compression and the low pressure that's necessary for evaporation. And this is the difference between the compression machines. This takes place by mechanical method.
What is mechanically driven?
Well, the compression that's achieved by the rapid absorption.
They just use a mechanical compressor and they don't use absorption.
That's the difference. And there's quite a bit of heat generated when the absorption takes place. So right here, through these pipes, there's some water running, and that tends to cool it down. From there, the aqua ammonia solution is pumped into the generator. It comes right here and comes into the generator. And one, I didn't show on this diagram, but this pipe right here goes through like this. And the aqua solution is returned later through this inner space. And when it's coming to the generator, it flows through the outer space. And this is a steam pump, and it heats the generator. And when ammonia and water are heated, they tend to separate. And when they're cooled, they tend to come together. So anyway, the high pressure and the heat drives the gas out up through here. And then cold water comes through this pipe and flows down over the pipes containing the ammonia gas. And that condenses it into a liquid. Then the water, this right here, is to catch the water that comes down. But the ammonia that's now liquid flows into the receiver. And then it's pumped back out through the refrigerator. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does it, except it would seem to me if that evaporation takes place in the upper left, then wouldn't that be the coldest place rather than the lower left?
Evaporates because it's got heat and play into it.
Was that a true evaporation at the left? Well, that's not a good question. What happened at the left exactly? Tell us again.
This aqua solution is heated.
That's a solution of ammonia and water. Is that right? Okay.
And that consequent high pressure forces the ammonia gas out up into the condenser.
What's that?
Wouldn't high pressure tend to hold it in?
I think it's a relative term when you say high pressure. It's a high pressure there, maybe one atmosphere compared to half an atmosphere over here.
So in other words, you're like if this was a camera or something, the heat, the energy source would be the heat that you use to drive the ammonia up. Like down on the lower left, you heat it up there, and then that's really the only outside energy source, isn't it? Is it?
I think it is, Grant. I'm not really sure about what the outside energy is. That's one part I don't understand. And yes.
What's that funnel thing for here?
Right.
Water.
This receives the water. See, water flows out of here over these pipes. I don't really understand the interaction between high pressure and low pressure as it was used in the material that I looked through.
Maybe the class does.
Yes.
I was just going to ask a question.
You'd rather not ask it.
Well, I thought you were going to spend the time now explaining that last one. But you got two water cooling places in here, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same loop?
What do you mean?
I mean, is water that cools in one spot then head down and cool in another spot before it heads out?
I don't know. Now, as you can see, I don't understand this completely, but I think you have sort of an idea of how it works. Dr. Hall, should I say something about the properties of ammonia?
Sure, go ahead.
Now, the thermodynamic properties, I don't really understand completely, but this isn't a complete list, but these are just some that seemed important to me. The critical temperature is sufficiently high, and the freezing temperature is sufficiently low that they're beyond the range of normal operation. So
do you have the temperatures there listed?
I don't.
What is the critical temperature?
It's the temperature at which it becomes explosive or something like that, is that right?
Not explosive.
Well, I don't know exactly.
Decomposes, is that what it does? I got told you once, but maybe only once. Anybody know what the critical temperature is?
Isn't it related to pressure?
Tell us what it is, Jeff.
Isn't it related to pressure, Jeff? Isn't there a critical pressure and temperature that two things are related?
Yes.
But is the critical temperature the highest temperature at which it can be liquefied?
Yes. See, if you're above what is called a critical temperature, a substance cannot exist as a liquid, no matter how much pressure you put on. And most substances will have what is called a critical temperature. In other words, it must exist as a gas. It can't be a solid and it can't be a liquid. If you're above a certain temperature, no matter how much you change the pressure, it will always be a gas. Maybe a very dense gas, but it will be a gas, not a liquid. And that's what we call the critical temperature.
Those dwarf stars like that, are they still gas?
I don't know. That's a different kind of stuff. No, you couldn't say that about those like dwarf stars.
Ammonia is completely non-corrosive to iron or steel, and it doesn't affect the packing and gasket materials that are usually used.
Doesn't affect what?
The packing and gasket materials.
Oh.
That are used. And as far as safety factors, it isn't very good because it's poisonous when inhaled. And under certain conditions, it will burn too. It doesn't burn easily, but it will burn. But it's fairly economic because it's the cheapest refrigerant except for water. And it's readily available. And if a leak does occur, it gives off enough odor so that it's easily detectable and it's easy to tell where a leak is. And I guess this kind of refrigeration has mostly had an industrial use. And that's all I have to say about this. Yes?
What's the lowest practical temperature you can operate such a refrigerator?
I don't know.
It would be that freezing point, wouldn't it? Freezing point of
imagine so much. Are there any more questions?
I'll let you and I discuss it some more before you pick that down. Now, in any situation where you have cooling water available, and by cooling water, you just mean you run water out of the tap, and it's usually cooler than the air. You will use it if it's available for cooling, because that can make your machine more efficient. It can make any machine. A refrigerator, as we said, is a heat engine run in reverse. And if there's a place where you need to cool and take heat away, you do it with cooling water. Now, in this modern day, you don't have much opportunity to do that. House refrigerators used to have cooling water come in and cool them. But later on, they just used the cooling of the air in the room. But in an industrial plant, they will often have a large well. And sometimes they'll have a well here, 100 feet from another well, and they'll pull the cold water out of the one well, run it through the coils to cool a refrigeration thing or something else, and then pump it down in the air through another well. As a matter of fact, they do that, you know where this building's energy research building is over on Columbia Lane, any of you? Mm-hmm. That was initially a TV station. And the TV station went broke, and then they sold it to the BYU as KBYU-TV. But then the university sold it. But in that original installation, they had to cool some of the big power tubes. The television station sends out millions of watts of electrical power. power, so they have to cool things to keep them from burning up. And they drilled an 8-inch well out there, several hundred feet deep, and then about 50 feet away another one, and they just pulled the water out of the one well, cool stuff off and pump it back in the ground. And sometimes that's more economical than using air cooling. And that will be done in a meat packing plant or an ice house where they have such a thing. Now, in principle, this could be operated just with air cooling, but it wouldn't be as efficient. And we do that with the refrigerators in our home. We just air cool the part that has to be cooled. So I think you can eliminate the water in both those places. But the only power here, as I see it, is the heat. In a large plant, they may have some electrically driven pumps and whatnot, but in principle, you wouldn't have to have. You just let heat drive the whole thing. And as you said, if you heat the ammonia and water solution here, ammonia is this, you see, NH3. It has a great affinity for water.
When it's cold.
Yeah, when it's cold. And it will form NH4OH, a basic substance in water. So over here, you heat it, you drive off the ammonia, and the water stays back in here. Was that the idea? Okay, and the water comes, the ammonia comes up here, now you want to cool it so it's a liquid, and that's why you cool it. And you take it over here, and now what did you say you had over here, an expansion valve at this point? And then what happened to it at this point?
Well, it goes through the refrigerator part and expands more and more.
So the pressure is lower here than it was over here when it came in, is that right? I think that's what you told me, and I would agree with that. And then what happens is it goes down through here there. As it expands, it...
It absorbs the heat.
It absorbs the heat. Okay. And then it moved down to here, and then what happened to it?
Then the water solution that's in the compressor absorbs the gas as it comes out this pipe.
Okay. So it was reabsorbed in the water, and heat's given up at that point, isn't it? And you had to take away that heat. And then you took it over to here, and then you heated it some more. Now how come you took away the heat here, and then you put it back there? Why did you do that? Okay.
Because the water wouldn't accept the ammonia if it wasn't cold, right?
Right. And if the ammonia dissolves here, what happens to the pressure in the pipe up here?
Gets too high.
It's the opposite. It gets lower, decreases, see? And with the lower pressure in here, then see the gas can expand into the lower pressure. The pressure is lower and it cools. They try to make it a liquid here. Now the object is to make it as efficient as you can. So if you can go from the liquid state to the gas state, that's better. You'll have more efficiency. More heat will be absorbed if you go from the liquid to the gas. Now you can just expand a gas and it will cool. But if you expand from a real condensed phase like a liquid to a gas, it will cool even more. So the whole idea, this is the pump, so to speak. What did they call this part?
The condenser.
The condenser, okay. And that's sort of the pump. The ammonia gas, again, condenses in the water when it's cool. And the strong affinity, see, the water, in essence, pulls the ammonia out. And so it decreases the amount of ammonia up here and pulls a vacuum in this region. So it's a non-mechanical pump. In a regular refrigerator, you have a mechanical pump driven by a motor, which can do similar of these things.
How do you separate the ammonia from the water again?
You heat it over here.
No, but doesn't the water and the ammonia both the only heat is so that the water remains liquid and the ammonia is gasified.
Yeah, I think that's right. I may be wrong on the ammonia being liquid over here. I'm not sure. I'm probably wrong.
I was just wondering, you know, temperature.
Ammonia is liquid at this point? Okay, you've got to cool it over here enough to make it liquid.
But to get it
maybe you couldn't do that without water cooling.
Get the water and the ammonia separated, there's probably a real critical temperature belt you have to operate in.
Probably. Mm-hmm.
So where's the really cold support?
In the refrigerator.
Over here.
What about Clayton's question?
What
about Clayton's question? Why doesn't it absorb the heat in the atmosphere when it's right here? Because it's gas there.
Well, it's still under pressure here, see? You have a valve here that means that from this heated part on, things are under pressure. And it's only when you expand it and let it vaporize. See, if you pull a vacuum on things, they will vaporize and cool. You decrease the pressure in any way. It need not be a vacuum, but in this case, this would be a partial vacuum in this part of the refrigerator. Higher pressure over here. High enough pressure over here so that it's actually a liquid ammonia here, and then you pass through the valve and it vaporizes, and you get the latent heat of, I was going to say fusion, the latent heat of vaporization out of the thing, and it cools. Okay, Greg, thank you. I make you want to become a refrigerator engineer, you got to stick with history.
That's right, history.
She'll tell you after she's got her grade.
See, in principle, anything that will give you a cooling could be used as a refrigerator. Anytime you can absorb heat. I said that incorrectly. Any time heat can be absorbed, in principle, you can make a refrigerator. Remember the day I pulled an elastic band on my cheek? Did any of you do that experiment? In principle, you can make that refrigerator back, see? Now, you may have problems, mechanical problems or other kind of problems, practical problems to solve. There are always practical problems to take the theory and make something out of it. But in practice, you could make a refrigerator out of some gadget that kept stretching a rubber band. Let's see, when you stretched it, it crystallized. I've forgotten, it gave up. It got warm when you stretched it and cool and released it. Okay, you stretch it out here, let it give up its heat to the air while it's in a stressed condition. Then you open the refrigerator door and stick it in, close the door real fast, and then you let it relax. And you do that thousands of times a second. And you got a refrigerator. And I bet you could make a refrigerator. You know, it may not be practical, but I bet you could actually build one. And it would do it. So the scheme is to use anything, any kind of a thing that will absorb heat at some stage of some mechanical process, and then you can make a refrigerator out of it.
Like, did they used to use heat with explosives?
It might be that it was used as a working fluid in a refrigerator. Now see, engines and refrigerators are just the reverse of each other, and each of them has a working fluid. Steam engine used water and its vapor as the working fluid. Gasoline engine, you use a complex mixture, air, which has nitrogen in it and other things, and you burn that with the fuel, and that burning mixture is your working fluid. An internal combustion engine, the fuel is itself the working fluid, and the composition of the working fluid changes with time. First it's just a mixture, and then it burns, and it burns to different degrees. So it's a complex working fluid. In this particular case, you have a complex working fluid that consists of water and ammonia, and they interact with each other. So it's sort of a two-fluid system. Now, the refrigerator in your camper, which uses heat, is an absorption-type refrigerator. And it would work just like this one, in
principle. But in the practical execution of the design, it would have to differ from this, because in a trailer you don't have lots of cooling water to run over to make it more efficient. You have to use air. And you use a different density of the liquids to create the flow, and you use gravity to cause certain stuff to flow down. You don't have any moving parts, you just use difference in density of liquids. Heat is the motivating force, the driving force. And you usually use other fluids than the water and the ammonia. Grace?
What's the difference between C1
and this one you just described? The working fluid would be different. And I'm not sure what the working fluid is in a cervelator fixture. It would work just like this, the same kind of a deal. It's a two-fluid system, but it won't. I don't believe it's water and don't believe it's ammonia. It's some organic liquid and some organic liquid which has somewhat the property. It plays the same role as the ammonia. What's that?
One of the books that I use referred to cervelas and ammonia sources.
Did it really? Well, I don't believe they use ammonia today in the modern ones. I could be wrong, but I just don't believe they do. I don't think that the safety codes would allow it in a practical camper type refrigerator or a household refrigerator. In the early days, I know they used ammonia, but I don't believe they do today. The principle is the same principle. Now, there are other kinds of refrigerators. The BYU cools most of the campus now with a refrigerator that works still differently. But it's an absorption type which uses a solid and water. And they use such things as ammonium bromide. Water. When you dissolve the ammonium bromide in the water, you get a cooling effect. It's a little different. It's not the same principle as the one you just described. There are certain salts, if you dissolve them in water, it gets cold. There are other salts, you dissolve them in water and the system gets hot. What you do is dissolve this stuff in the water, and it cools, and then you take the mixture over here someplace else and you boil the water off with heat. You get back the ammonium chloride, which then you again dissolve in the water. Now, they don't take this in the evaporation, they don't take this clear to dryness. What they actually have is a very concentrated solution of ammonium bromide in water after they boil off the water over here. And then return that liquid solution, which is very high in this, and add that to pure water, and it cools. They keep it going around and around. And the water chiller, the newest addition to the physical plant over there, does that. And they use that for air conditioning. Now, this kind of a system, where you dissolve some kind of a salt in water to get a cooling effect, it doesn't give you enough cooling for a refrigerator, but it gives you enough cooling for air conditioning. All you want to do is take air at about 100 degrees or whatever it is and chill it down to about 60 degrees and then ship it around the campus in big pipes about that big around. Okay, Cindy?
Is that the principle that's operating when you put table salt in water and it'll boil faster? Is it it's giving off heat when it...
No, that's something different. When you put table salt in water, that keeps the water molecules from getting away because sodium ions and chloride ions are in the way. And in effect, you increase the vapor pressure and you heat it hotter before it boils. Yeah, sub-microscopic level, it's a sort of a physical problem of things getting in the way. Here I have in my beaker just water molecules, which I'll represent by open circles. And they're just moving around in there as a liquid moves. Well, now if I take sodium chloride, which is a white salt, in water, gives sodium ions, fluoride ions. These ions, it doesn't matter what they are represented as filled in circles. And at the surface, where these things are trying to get away, there are some of these other atoms that are in the way, and they can't get away as easily.
Well, that should make it boil less fast, wouldn't it?
Well, it boils at a higher temperature. You have to heat it hotter to get the same vapor pressure.
Okay, but...
So if you're a Boy Scout and you're trying to boil an egg on Tempanogos, you can't. You take out the big box of salt that you brought and you dissolve as much of it as you can in the water and you raise the boiling point of the water.
Okay, well, why does that make it boil faster if you raise
the water? Well, it doesn't boil faster. I'm not sure what you mean by it. When you use the adjective faster, what do you mean?
Well, it doesn't, every time I've done it, it doesn't take as much time to it
takes less time to boil? Well, the only way I could explain that is that it's a thermal conductivity effect. It might be that the salt may carry heat into the water molecules more rapidly. That's a kinetic effect and not a thermodynamic effect. Jeff?
Well, if the ions were obstructing the water molecules breaking on from the surface, like the phase boundary, wouldn't that cause the water to heat up much faster because it wasn't being able to release this energy through steam? And so that it might boil faster. You know, you might get critical and you have to heat it up hotter, but it would heat up faster in order to offset the higher temperature because you could release that temperature. Yeah, it would be like...
Well, that is a factor, and that's probably true. See, you're not going to get as... When the water molecules leak, they take heat with them. So many calories per mole. Quite a bit of heat. A lot of heat, as a matter of fact. And so what you say is true. If the heat is being kept up in because the molecules aren't leaving, then, of course, more heat is in here to heat the thing up. Okay. I'll buy that. All right?
I have a question about cooling devices. What keeps a refrigerator from getting colder and colder and colder?
Heat losses. Heat losses and the property of the working fluids. The working fluids themselves, if they cool down to a certain place, the gaseous part will cease to exist and be all liquid, for example. May even freeze into a solid. So there's a limit on a refrigerator due to the freezing points and boiling points of the materials you use. Now, for the ultimate refrigerator to cool to the lowest temperature, you have to use the gas which has the lowest freezing point. That gas is helium. For approaching the absolute zero of temperature, you use helium gas because it is still a fluid, either a liquid or a gas. They're down to, I don't know, 1 degree Kelvin or even lower, almost to absolute zero.
Can you solidify helium?
Hmm?
I mean, is it possible to solidify helium at one atmosphere at low temperature?
Yes, you have to even reduce the pressure on it to get it down to the lower temperature.
Have they solidified helium?
No, if you want to solidify it, then you increase the pressure.
But if they have any of them solidified?
Yeah, it's a real soft solid, extreme, probably the softest of all solids. Even when frozen, it's like butter. It's solid, it's definitely a crystalline solid, but like butter. It's really soft.
What gives it those strange properties?
Well, there are some quantum mechanical effects that I do not know the detailed nature of. But in addition to that, of course, this material, you see, it has a... the nucleus of two protons and a couple of neutrons, and then it has these two electrons. That's a very unique and stable situation. And it doesn't want to form bonds with anything else, not even with itself. And so it remains a gas to a lower temperature than any other known substance.
How far down will neon go?
Neon doesn't go nearly as low. The next best thing to helium is hydrogen. Double bond, two atoms of hydrogen.
Well, how do you cool down to, what, a tenth of a degree, absolute zero?
All right, you have a multi-stage refrigerator. It's just like the ordinary mechanical refrigerator in your house. More efficient, different working fluids, and I don't know the exact working fluids, the fluids that they use. But you got to have working fluids that can go to a lower temperature without freezing. See, if you used ammonia and water, your water would freeze at some place, and your refrigerator would cease to work. But then they cool in stages. With our refrigerator, they will cool a working fluid that will go to a still lower temperature, and still lower temperature. Some of the earlier refrigerators had dozens of stages. Now I think they have refrigerators that use helium only as the working fluid. But it goes through a lot of stages in a continuous sort of a way. You're in chem engineering? Somebody was here. It's not a batch process. It's a continuous process. And I think they use helium as the working fluid all the way.
So the same batch of working fluid would go through all the stages?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a multi-stage thing. They cool what is cool, even cooler, and just continue that right on down. Then, for the ultimate refrigeration, when you've got the helium so that it's a liquid, then you just vaporize the helium, and you can do it with a simple pump. Yeah, just pull a vacuum on the helium and control the rate of evaporation, and you can cool down within a thousandth of a degree of absolute zero just by evaporation. The heat of evaporation of liquid helium. Now, there were some other tricks that they used to use in former days, but I think they're all out of style now because of helium refrigerators, which are more efficient. It used to be in the early days of cryogenic, and that's what you call real low tension, cryogenic engineering, that they could only get down to maybe 1 degree. Or maybe it's even higher than that, 5 degrees. So they used what they called magnetic cooling. There are phenomena other than, see, the phenomena we've been dealing with are the dissolution of gases in liquids, or liquids in liquids, or solids in liquids, or the expansion of gases. All of these things will cool. All of these phenomena will cool. But there are the phenomena that will cause cooling. This elastic band thing is a little different, you see, and that will cool. There are magnetic effects which will cool. You put something in a magnetic field and then turn a magnet on, and it can align atoms up, and the aligning of the atoms up is an ordering process. And then you remove the magnetic field and the atoms, particularly, I'm speaking of atoms, but actually it's the nucleus of atoms that do this. Then the nuclei realign themselves in the magnetic field in a random pattern, and heat is absorbed in that process. They call that magnetic cooling. And when I went to school, they got the lowest temperatures that there were by this magnetic cooling. They used salts of gadolinium for that purpose. But nowadays, I'm pretty sure they don't monkey with that. They know how to do it just with helium alone. They call it a helium refrigerator. Okay?
When you adjust the temperature in your refrigerator with one of those dials, does that mean that they put more of the freon in?
The only thing that does is regulate how often your compressor comes on. You know, you can hear your refrigerator running and then it's quiet. If you want to cool more, when you turn that dial, it just adjusts some springs and whatnot. Some of them work on a timer basis. It makes your timer turn your compressor on every 10 minutes instead of every hour or something like that. All it means is your compressor comes on more often, and then it will cool down to a colder temperature. Now, Grace mentioned that air had been used as a refrigerant. Well, that was tried in the early days, and then it was abandoned for a long, long time.
in favor of other systems, ammonia, and in household refrigeration, particularly the things that are called the freons, the fluoro, chloro, hydrocarbons. But now there's an interest in using air again as a refrigerant, particularly for automobiles. Now the reason for that is your refrigerator can be a lot simpler. Now all you do is do the same thing. You compress the air and then you expand. You compress the air. In compressing any substance, you don't even compress it down to the liquid state. You just compress it just to a denser gaseous state. Heat is released when you compress a liquid. Well, you compress anything. But if you compress a gas, you can remove a lot of heat. Give off a lot of heat and remove it. And then, after the heat is removed to room temperature by letting the air flow across a radiator, the ordinary radiator, remove the heat of compression. Then you move that air to a new location and let it expand and it will cool. So they have some gizmos for doing that now that are very simple. And they don't use a freon type refrigerator, and General Motors and others are experimenting with these things. So you just pull in outside air and compress it in a special kind of a compressor, then expand it and let that expanded air come directly into the automobile. Now, the principle works just fine, but like many things in engineering, there happen to be some problems. And the problem is that there happens to be water vapor in the air. And these things cool very efficiently. And the water vapor in the air becomes ice, and it blows snow into the driver's department, which I guess would be all right, but the snow accumulates in the expansion nozzle and actually freezes up and blocks the passage of the air. So the technical problem with using these working fluid of air refrigeration systems for air conditioning and automobiles is simply somehow to separate out the ice crystals that are formed on account of the moisture that's in the air. And I think they're pretty close to overcoming that. And if you could install this kind of a refrigerant for air conditioning in cars, the gadget itself would cost only about half as much as the present kind of a gadget. And you wouldn't have to worry about the freon leaking out and whatnot, because just all the air that's out there is your refrigerant.
I was reading about this thing in hardware science. It's a nozzle. It was designed in the late 1800s, okay, but it was inefficient. You pump compressed air into this specially designed nozzle. Hot air comes out one side and cold air comes out the other.
No. Do you remember the name of that?
No.
I've forgotten the name. It's somebody's tube.
Yeah.
A vortex tube of some kind.
Yeah, how does it work? I mean, how does it separate the energetic molecules from the non-energetic molecules and then zap them out?
Okay, we haven't said much about the kinetic theory of gases. With gases, you can apply the mathematical science of statistics rather exactly to develop all the thermodynamics of gases from a theoretical point of view nowadays. And this science, when you apply it to chemistry or physics, is called statistical mechanics. Now, it's a difficult, complicated thing, but we can give you a mental picture of what a gas is. Now, you have to make some assumptions for an ideal gas. An ideal gas is a gas which obeys the perfect gas law, which says PV equals nRT. All gases are ideal if the pressure is low and or the temperature is high. And I think I've told you that on a couple of occasions. Now, a gas is ideal if, one, they're considered to be invisible, the molecules are invisible points. Now, your mind can think of such things, even though they can't be there. They take up no room in space at all. You use such a concept in mathematics, a mathematical point. Maybe that's a better term. The molecules are mathematical points. The second
second thing, that there are no attractive or repulsive forces between the molecules. They have no influence on each other. Just neutral. Now, with those two assumptions, you can go to the statistical theories of mathematics. And you can derive the perfect gas law and many of the thermodynamic laws concerned with gases. Now, here's the general idea about kinetic theory of gases. Particles are always in motion. And I think you have that general notion. And there's a statistical range of the motion. If it's a gas like helium, you can assume this mathematical point to just be traveling at random, completely at random. It'll be going along and suddenly it'll change its direction. It's just a random direction of motion. Now, there'd be trillions and trillions of these molecules in any space. But there's a range of energies that depends on their velocities. Their velocities will always be different. It will collide with another atom. This velocity will change. Now, this can be modified. The idea of a mathematical point can and is modified when you go to such things as an NH3 molecule. No longer can this be a mathematical point, because you not only have to consider the translational motion. Translational motion is just this zigzag motion through space that I was describing for helium. But when you have something like ammonia, you have to know its structure. And ammonia is like a nitrogen sitting as the seat on a three-legged stool of hydrogen atoms. Now, you not only have that kind of a motion, but you have two vibrational motions, which is due to the stretching of the bond between the nitrogen and the hydrogen. The nitrogen and the hydrogen are sitting there doing that, all three of them, like that. And then there are bending motions. This thing is bending back and forth like that. And then it's rotating in three-dimensional space. So you'll have the rotations, the vibrations, and the translational motions. The bending moments are minor things, but you have to take care of those. And these are all expressed in mathematics. So it's the minute atomic and molecular motions that are strictly distributed in statistical fashions that a mathematician and a good enough chemist, I used to do this back in the days when I was a theoretical chemist, I could make all these computations, but that was almost 30 years ago. Oh, I used it more recently than that. I've used it within the past 10 years, I guess, but not too much lately. Well, let's see, how do we get off onto that? We're going to talk about cooling? We're going to explain your thing. All right. Now, temperature is assumed to be related to this. Temperature is related to the kinetic energy of the molecules or atoms or whatever it is in the gas. The higher the kinetic energy, the higher the tension. Now, there are two kinds of energy. There's potential energy and there's kinetic energy. Potential energy is the latent energy. For instance, this chalk has latent gravitational energy. I could let loose of it and it could do some work. I could make an engine that would utilize the work of that